Hello, everyone. I'm Molly Wood. Welcome back to Make Me Smart, the podcast where none of us is as smart as all of us. I am getting extra help today because Kai is off and all our reporters are reporting. And so it's just going to be me in the chair, which actually I'm a little grateful for because today's conversation is going to take a lot of focus and is worth kind of the time, I think, to get to dive deep with a single conversation into a single topic. And not surprisingly, that topic is policing in America. It has been 1 year today, as I'm recording this, since the murder of George Floyd, which of course sparked global protests about racial injustice. And of course, this national debate about police funding. So today we're going to dig into the history of spending on policing in this country, how we got to where we are, where the defund movement is today, and whether rising crime rates, the political environment that we're in, where states are actually attempting to pass laws, I think, as we speak, stopping municipalities from defunding the police. So whether partisanship and all of the things that are happening, this stew that is America right now, will influence where the defund discussion goes from here. Here to make us smart is Elizabeth Hinton, a professor of history and African American studies at Yale University and author of the new book America on Fire, The Untold History of Police Violence and Black Rebellion Since the 1960s. Professor, thanks so much for coming on.
Thanks for having me, Molly. I'm really happy to be here.
Help us put this into context. How has police funding evolved over time, and how does it inform this debate we're having right now?
So I think in order to understand where we are with policing today, we really have to go back to 1965, which began the kind of federal intervention into local police and prisons and court systems for the first time in U.S. history when Lyndon Johnson declares the war on crime. And all of a sudden, the federal government started funding experimental programs in mostly major metropolitan centers like New York and Los Angeles and Chicago and Baltimore, both with new kind of policing programs that expanded police forces in these major cities, but also in transferring surplus military-grade weapons from Vietnam and Latin America to these urban police forces. So all of a sudden, the LAPD gets a helicopter gifted to it from the federal government to better police targeted Black and brown communities in the cities, in the city. And police departments across the country begin receiving armored tanks and bulletproof vests and riot control gear and new training and professionalization. This is really the moment when the federal government steps in and says, there's a crisis in policing. Crime seems to be rising. There's all this rioting, so-called rioting or political violence in our communities, and we have to equip our police and expand policing forces in order to fight it better. The real turning point comes in 1968 with the Omnibus Crime Control and Safe Streets Act, which was one of the last major pieces of domestic legislation that Lyndon Johnson signed, which made more permanent these experimental programs that had kind of been running the course earlier in the 1960s, and marks an initial $400 million or several billion in today's dollars investment into expanding police, into equipping them with better weapons, into training programs and professionalizations, and lays the groundwork for the kind of policing strategies, tactics, and methods that we still see today. And eventually, with the increase in and investment in police, prisons to then house the people who police are now arresting at unprecedented rates in targeted communities.
So previously, states had sort of managed their own policing. It sounds like you're saying, what was this in response to? What prompted this sense that crime was rising and they needed all this federal intervention, notwithstanding possibly a lot of spare military gear from a failed war?
Right. So, of course, this federal intervention cannot be separated from the demographic changes of the 1960s. For one, I mean, cities like D.C. had come into a Black majority, and cities like Detroit and Cleveland were edging a Black minority. Middle class and white Americans are moving to the suburbs. In addition to that, you begin to see incidents of collective violence, what Johnson and other officials referred to as riots, popping up in nearly every major city during his presidency, and as my work shows, in thousands of others following the enactment of that Safe Streets Act legislation. So the war on crime was both an attempt to deal with the demographic changes facing American society and prevent the threat of future rebellion. Part of the strategy for controlling that rebellion was to expand police and to get police the best weapons the federal government could buy them or transfer them from other various wars it was fighting overseas.
At the time that this happened, back in 1968, there was a countervailing view put forth by the Kerner Commission in a report that was essentially ignored and put us on the path that we're on today. Can you tell us about that report?
Yeah, so the Kerner Commission is one of the kind of biggest miss. The Kerner Commission's report is one of the biggest missed opportunities. Johnson called the Kerner Commission in the middle of the Detroit Rebellion in 1967 to help him evaluate the causes of the urban unrest that had rocked so many cities during his presidency, and also to come up with solutions to prevent it in the future. And, you know, I was just talking about the solution that policymakers embraced was rooted in policing, professionalizing police forces, and increasing surveillance in targeted communities. But the Kerner Commission said, if we really want to prevent rebellion in the future, and if we really want to deal with the fact, as the Kerner Commission famously acknowledged, that the United States is moving toward, quote, two societies, one black, one white, separate and unequal, what's required is essentially a Marshall Plan for American cities. The Kerner Commission said, we need a massive infusion of resources into low-income communities of color. We need the public and private sector to partner together and mobilize to create jobs for low-income Americans. We need to invest in public school systems. We need to create robust schools and educational opportunities for disadvantaged Americans. That was what the terminology the Kerner Commission used. We need a complete overhaul of public housing. Public housing was deteriorating. People were living in slum conditions, and slum landlords were perpetuating conditions of poverty in low-income urban areas. The Kerner Commission recommended greater access to health care, you name it, essentially programs that would help ensure the full political and economic inclusion of racially marginalized Americans in U.S. society.
And yet, we went in the opposite direction. I mean, to put it plainly, it sounds like you're saying that that was a racist response, that this increase in policing and militarization was fundamentally a racist response, that this report came out and said, actually, racism and lack of opportunity is the root of the problems you are trying to address with this militarization. And then the racist response to the report was to double down on the first part.
Exactly. Exactly. And instead of the kind of massive investment in resources for communities that the Kerner Commission and that residents who felt they had no other option but to resort to political violence were demanding, the federal government gave this massive investment in policing and surveillance and incarceration that eventually won out over Johnson's own war on poverty. So instead of the job creation program for low-income Americans that the Kerner Commission was talking about, the Johnson administration in the end supported a job creation program for police. And we're living with the consequences of that decision today.
It sounds like that decision has also been made many times throughout American history, right? That there were commissions formed to study unrest in Chicago in 1919, unrest in Harlem in 1935 and 43, 1965, all with similar conclusions.
Right, right. We already know what the answer is. The answer is, if we want to address racism and inequality, then we have to think about how we distribute resources in our society. We certainly don't need another commission to evaluate the kind of causes of tensions between police and the communities that they patrol, and solutions to the problem of inequality. We know what's required. It's a new set of investments, and with that too, I mean, it's a set of reform. Police reform is on the political legislative agenda right now. People have been calling for it for some time. The clamor grew in the aftermath of George Floyd's murder exactly a year ago. But we have to look beyond police reform. And that was one of the things that the Kerner Commission emphasized in its report. It's saying if we want to talk about crime prevention and we want to talk about public safety, then we have to start with improving overall conditions and creating some kind of an equity, more equitable conditions, more equitable institutions in our society, and to expand opportunities to people that have been historically denied opportunity due to systemic racism.
Mm-hmm. And I feel like all of this is the crucial context for the phrase defund the police, which a lot of white people heard for the first time in the last year, but that has been around for decades with exactly this data behind it, right?
Exactly. Exactly. When I hear defund the police, I think of it as a call for a different set of investments. I think one thing that we know is that the decision that was made during this crucial time in the 60s to invest in police and prisons to manage the material effects of poverty and inequality as they emerged through poverty and crime in low-income communities rather than in what people, what residents wanted and what the Kerner Commission suggested, you know, in jobs, in schools, in healthcare, in housing, has led us to this place that hasn't effectively worked to keep the most vulnerable communities safe. And I see it as one of the biggest domestic policy failures in the history of this country. So when people are talking about defund the police or calling for defund the police, they're saying, we want a different set of investments of our taxpayer dollars into communities. This hasn't worked. It's extremely expensive. There are other more cost-effective ways and more humane ways that we can better foster public safety in the communities that are the most susceptible to violence or social harm and crime, and with it, over-policing and incarceration.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about that, you know, the effectiveness, the ineffectiveness, rather. Last year, the Washington Post analyzed 60 years of state and local police spending and found that it has basically no impact on crime, meaning that the biggest argument, the biggest sort of fear-based argument about defunding the police is crime will go up. How do we sort of tell this story that these two are actually not that correlated?
Yeah, and the same goes for incarceration. I think, you know, the logic, especially in the 1990s when prison populations were really exploding, you know, is that incarceration serves as a crime deterrent, and we know that's just not true. And time and time again, I mean, even through the 60s and 70s, we know that the community-based crime prevention programs, tenant patrols, and that were funded fleetingly by the federal government in the late 60s and early 70s. And today, some of the most promising violent reduction programs were where people who have been involved in gang violence or incarcerated are working with youth directly who are susceptible to getting shot or shooting other people. Are far cheaper than policing programs. It's far cheaper than incarcerating a young person at upwards of $20,000 or $30,000 a year, and have a far greater impact in actually reducing crime and actually addressing the problem in a meaningful way. We know that crime and public safety is a local issue, and therefore it should be further entrusted to communities to keep the community safe and to address specific public safety needs within a given community rather than an outsider with a gun showing up to situations where that kind of intervention may or may not be appropriate and could indeed and has proven to, in fact, escalate violence and worsen the problem.
Where are we now? Has this movement gained traction? I know there have been some municipalities that have taken steps toward defunding. Others haven't. Meanwhile, there's a national conversation about violent crime being on the rise. What's your sort of level of hope in this moment?
Yeah. So, you know, I think one of the things that my work shows and that the history of police reform and the post-civil rights period shows is that it hasn't effectively gotten to the root causes of the problem, that, you know, we have to look beyond the police and have an expansive vision of public safety that is rooted in the kind of needs of the community itself, rather than the police as kind of the only solution. And we're beginning to see moves in this direction. I'm really inspired by what's going on in Ithaca, New York, where recently the city council and the police union essentially voted to abolish the police department and replace it with the Department of Community Solutions and Public Safety, which supports a different set of first responders. So not always a uniformed officer with a gun responding to a domestic violence issue or a mental health crisis or even a traffic stop, and emphasizing public health and public safety rather than controlling crime and capturing criminals as the kind of purpose and function of what used to be police work. You know, what we're seeing on the table in Congress with the George Floyd Justice Act is in many ways behind the times, in the sense that we know that, like, better training for police and even things like banning the use of chokeholds is not necessarily going to effectively prevent police killings in the future or improve public safety. It's, again, these community-based measures and a kind of new conception of what public safety can and should be that's going to lead to more vibrant communities in the end, and that's going to eventually stop the indiscriminate murders of low-income men and women of color throughout this country, a problem that has plagued the nation historically.
And fundamentally, racism, right, is just such a huge barrier to this conversation. It just feels like over and over I hear surveys where white Americans say this isn't that big a deal and black Americans say this is the only deal.
Right. I mean, fundamentally, I mean, that's what it comes down to. That's what it all comes down to. And it's a hearts and minds campaign in that sense. And that's why here I think history is so important, because if we don't understand the history of racial oppression in this country, we're never going to understand how we got here and how we might move forward in the future. But historically, you know, we know that political and economic elites have been really resistant to fundamentally disrupting the racial hierarchies that have defined this country since its founding. So we can look to the history of protest movements and struggles for racial justice to keep the pressure on, and also to help shift public opinion. I am emboldened and inspired, though, by younger generations who I think are really beginning to move the conversation forward and want to create and want to live in a more equitable and just society. I think about my students, and I think about the young people who really steered the protests last summer, what some have called the largest mass mobilization in U.S. history. And I hope that this generation is not going to stand for the status quo for the past 400 years in this country.
Elizabeth Hinton is a professor of history and African American studies at Yale University, author of the new book America on Fire: The Untold History of Police Violence and Black Rebellion Since the 1960s. I feel weirdly devastated and also hopeful.
Good. I mean, so do I. So that's a good thing.
An appropriate outcome. Kind of. Thank you so much. I really appreciate it again.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Molly.
Take good care.
It's been great. You too. Bye.
All right. And with that, we are headed to a break. Send us your comments on today's show. History is so instructive and, as I said, devastating and hopefully hopeful. You can reach us by email. We love the voice memos. MakeMeSmart@marketplace.org. Love to hear your thoughts, and we'll be right back.
With the launch of ChatGPT, Sam Altman and OpenAI reinvigorated our imaginations and fears of a world with artificial intelligence. While the company looked like a stunning success from the outside, a battle was brewing within on what the future of AI should be. Almost a year after launching ChatGPT, that battle erupted into a war when the company fired its charismatic CEO, Sam Altman. From Wondery, Business Wars is a podcast about the biggest corporate rivalries of all time. And in the newest season, host David Brown digs into the philosophical differences within OpenAI that culminated in Sam Altman's shocking firing, the chaos that followed, and what it means for the future and safety of AI in the modern world. Follow Business Wars on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus. And for more deep dive and daily business content, listen on Wondery, the destination for business podcasts, with shows like How I Built This, Business Wars, The Best One Yet, Business Movers, and many more. Wondery means business.
All right, we are going to skip the news fix because Kai is out and it's just not fun to talk about the news without him. Let's let you guys talk for a minute and go straight to the mailbag.
Hello, Molly and Kai.
It's Brianna from Phoenix.
Ivan from Brooklyn, New York.
Longtime listener, first time voicemailer.
I want to discuss a slightly different but maybe related thing.
So a lot of times what happens on our show is that people are smarter than we are and they listen and then they write in and educate us on about the things that we thought we liked. So a few weeks back, we were talking about the Top Gun theme music and how I am obsessed with songs that have awesome key changes. We got a voice memo from Benjamin Cornelius Bates, a professor of musicianship at Duquesne University in Pittsburgh. And he says, nope. I was totally wrong about the Top Gun theme music, which I described as all one big key change. Evidently, the technical term for that is transpositions. And he says, this is what actually is happening in my favorite song.
But in fact, is actually a really cool, weird, and unique kind of transposition. So the piece starts in C major and eventually moves to F sharp major. You may have noticed that those two keys do not sound like they have much in common, and they don't. What's weird is how it gets from C major to F sharp, these two distant keys, and rather than use a little thing called a dominant, which I'll demonstrate like this, it uses two chords in between as a minor third away from each other, which sounds like this. Now here's my shorthand version of the theme with a transposition. Really cool.
I mean... Right? I know. I'm with you. I thought I was going to be really mad because it was going to be a well actually about the Top Gun theme song. But in fact, it was amazing. And it reminded me, my boyfriend's gotten me obsessed with watching these Rick Beato videos on YouTube where he breaks down guitar riffs from songs. And it should be the most unbearable thing ever. And in fact, it's amazing. And plus, Benjamin, thanks for calling in and playing my favorite song for me. All right, now we're going to leave you with the answer to the Make Me Smart question, which, of course, is what is something you thought you knew and you later found out you were wrong about? Barbara in Petaluma, California, sent us this.
Something that I thought I knew that I was completely wrong about has to do with LeBron James. When he first came into the NBA, all I thought about was another overpaid NBA player that's all about him. And boy, has he evolved, and boy, have I been wrong. He has evolved into such a passionate activist that it's really fabulous to see that he puts his money where his mouth is and has been so engaged in so many aspects of our democracy. Hats off to you, King James.
Man, this is a tough one for me because that is all really true. And if I see that guy pretend to lose an eye in another basketball game against my team, the Warriors, I'm not going to be able to remember all the good things. Barbara, you're right. You're right. All of you are correct. Everyone can be right at the same time, which is a great lesson for today. Don't forget to send us your answer to the Make Me Smart question. I love our audience, which is, what is something you thought you knew and you later found out you were wrong about? You can reach us at makemesmart@marketplace.org. Sorry, guys, that was a flop. It was a giant flop. I mean, if I had a nickel for every time the man lost an eye in a basketball game and then came back and hit a brutal three-point shot with just his one working eye. Okay. Make Me Smart is produced and directed by Marissa Cabrera. So many emails are going to happen now. Tony Wagner is our digital producer. Erica Phillips writes our newsletter and our smart speaker skill. Today's program was engineered by Liana Squillaci with mixing by the new guy, Juan Carlos Torrado. Ben Tolliday and Daniel Ramirez composed our theme music. The senior producer is Donna Tam, and the executive director of On Demand is Sitar Nieves. That was very SoCal producers coming for the NorCal. La flop.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.